Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian authorities probe a Christmas Eve attack by gunmen in North Central Plateau State that killed over 140 civilians.
A similar kind of attack took place in May. About 100 people were killed. And this is just barely 6 months, 113 or so were killed again.
A new food analysis warns of acute food shortages in Sudan. Conservationists in Kenya warn that nearly all the country's 103 species of raptors are in decline. The head of the Anglican Church in South Sudan calls on all signatories to the revised peace agreement to complete the benchmarks in the country's roadmap. And a California company is converting jet fuel aircraft to run on hydrogen to reduce emissions that harm the environment.
It says this is the highest level of hunger ever recorded during the current harvest season, a period when more food is available.
And Christmas and New Year messages from our listeners. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian authorities are investigating a Christmas Eve attack by gunmen in remote villages in North Central Plateau State that killed over 140 civilians. It was the latest of such mass killings this year, blamed on the country's farmer herder crisis. Plateau Governor Caleb Mofuang said 17 communities were targeted in, quote, senseless and unprovoked, unquote, attacks. Dr. Abubakar Mohamed Sani is senior advisor to former Nigerian Chief of Army Staff, Tuku Yusuf Buratai. He says the conflict may escalate if the killings continue.
A similar kind of attack took place in May. About 100 people were killed. And this is just barely 6 months. 113 or so were killed again. And we don't see enough offensive attack by this very Operation Safe Haven, even the police. We see a lot of defensive operations, which to me is not the best way to go. Now, if locals who decide to be law-abiding, they don't want to go procure arms because the Nigerian law forbids it, and they have surrendered their power and everything to the state to protect them. If the state is unable to do that, and over time it has become the norm that the state is unable to protect them, what do you expect them to do? The next thing they will do is to go procure arms and resort to self-help. In fact, their leaders are now telling them they must do everything they need to protect themselves. They may not come out openly to say that this is what they would do, but I can tell you the people have lost faith in the government and in the security forces to protect them. This conflict, if they are not taken, will escalate to a level that it might even engulf the entire Middle East. Because as this thing is happening in Plateau State, we see a lot of similarity of what is happening in Plateau State in Benue State. And the bandits, the ISWAP, the terrorists, taken over a number of villages in Niger State. They are there. People are paying taxes to these bandits in part of Niger State to access their farms, to harvest their product. I think this is a clarion call for the government. Enough of all these excuses. You understand? Enough. Enough of it.
Do you share the fears by some experts, some analysts, that these bandits or their supporters have infiltrated certain sections of the Nigerian security apparatus?
The only thing I would say I agree with if you say there are moves that are saboteurs within the Nigerian security establishment, I will agree with that. People who are being paid by the taxpayers' money to provide services of security to the people who are, instead of doing that, you know, taking vital information of government, of security to the enemy, so that the enemy can exploit the weaknesses and gaps of the government security architecture. I think I will say that exists. But I think what I would rather say is this, the people who are overseeing some of the security establishment of the government, by and large, I would say you tend to see more of negligence here and there, where you expect to see diligence, where you expect to see professionalism. You don't see it. People give them intelligence. We have seen suspicious movement in this area and now part of the bush. You people should take action. And you see they will not act on it. They will ignore it. So you see that's negligence. there is more negligence in the way they handle their duties. Why is this still not happening in Abuja? Why is it not happening with governors and their families and their children? It's only the areas where you see the masses are there.
You advised a former Nigerian chief of army staff. Based on your experience, what would you be advising the government to do right now to put a stop to these terrible killings and attacks on defenseless civilians?
My advice to the government is to address the issue of bad governance, economic wastage, create opportunities for the people, strengthen the judiciary in such a way that Nigerians can say this judiciary is not a cash and carry judiciary system. Then after that, they must assemble a team of competent people who have the requisite experience to see that security is sustained and maintained and sustained in the country. These are all fundamental. Once people see they have been victimized and you use the judiciary to tamp and legalize injustice, they will revert to self-help, non-state actors and whatever to agitate for their right. There is too much injustice in the country. The anger against the government, the frustration will douse down, will reduce, and you can now begin to say, okay, you walk towards peace.
That's Dr. Abubakar Mohamed Sani, senior advisor to former Nigerian Chief of Army Staff, General Tukur Yusuf Buratai, speaking with me from Maiduguri, Borno State. A mass funeral was held for 19 of the 20 victims of an attack in Gatumba in western Burundi on Tuesday. Gunmen on Friday killed at least 20 people and wounded 9 others near Burundi's western border with the DRC, the government told reporters in an attack claimed by the Red Tabara rebel group. Those killed in the evening raid on a village called Vizugi included 12 children, 2 pregnant women, and a police officer, government spokesman said. Red Tabara, which has been battling Burundi's government from bases in eastern DRC since 2015, claimed on the social media platform X to have killed 9 soldiers and 1 police officer. Local residents said they heard shots of gunfire and explosions during the attack. A new food analysis warns of looming acute food shortages in Sudan. Lisa Schlein reports.
A new food analysis by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, a very scientific evaluation of food security, warns 18 million people across Sudan face acute hunger. It says this is the highest level of hunger ever recorded during the current harvest season, a period when more food is available. United Nations agencies say ongoing conflict, escalating violence, low agricultural production, high food prices, climate shocks, and displacement are exacerbating the food crisis. Adam Yao is the deputy food and agriculture representative in Sudan. He says hunger in this war-torn country will reach new levels during the lean season in May when food stocks are at their lowest. Speaking from Sudan's Sennar state, he told journalists that more financial support and unimpeded access to people trapped in conflict hotspots are needed to ward off the worst.
The Sudanese people require more support, more than ever. Our immediate action to preserve the life and livelihood of rural Sudanese community is absolutely crucial. The longer we take to respond, the more life we expose to the imminent threat of famine.
Today marks 8 months since rival generals from the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary support response forces plunged Sudan into a conflict described as one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. The World Food Program says the war has unleashed terror, violence, displacement, and immeasurable suffering. Despite this, WFP spokesperson for Sudan, Lenny Kensley, says the crisis is not getting the international focus and attention that is warranted. Speaking from Nairobi, Kenya, Kensley says regular and safe humanitarian access to civilians in areas worst hit by violence is inadequate, as is international financial support for a crisis of this magnitude.
Since the start of the conflict, WFP has provided life-saving assistance to over 5 million people, preventing an even worse deterioration of food security, especially in eastern and northern Sudan. Yet this is only scratching the surface compared to the immense needs that we are seeing on ground.
WFP reports only 1 in 5 people most urgently in need of food assistance in the Khartoum area has received it since the conflict started. It says it has been able to provide food aid to 500,000 people from Chad to West and Central Darfur since August. However, it notes WFP has been unable to provide desperately needed food to people in other parts of Darfur since June. This because armed groups have refused guarantees of safe access to the volatile areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Chinedu Ofor in Washington, filling in for James Batty. Today is Wednesday, December 27th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The head of the Anglican Church in South Sudan, Archbishop Justin Badi Amara, is calling on all signatories of the revitalized peace agreement to complete the benchmarks in the country's roadmap as South Sudanese prepares for elections in December 2024. Amara says South Sudanese celebrate Christmas and usher in the new year. He remains hopeful that 2024 will bring change to the country. VOA's managing editor John Tanza sat down with the Archbishop at his residence in Juba to discuss some of the challenges facing the country.
Christmas is the demonstration of God's love to the world and God's intervention into human challenges. We know in 2023 there were good things that have happened, and also there were some challenges that have happened, but we rejoice to God that we were able to go through all these things.
Let's talk about the good things that you're saying that happened. What are these good things?
The good things we saw as a church, we were able to move around the country with the evangelism, discipleship, and also to have regular worship in all our churches across South Sudan. That was something we were able to thank God for. And secondly, we also saw that the parties to the revitalized peace agreement were able to stick to what they signed on, and we did not see any major exchange of guns, which we are grateful for that. And we see that the revitalized government have also made some steps in forming some committees and institutions that will pave way for the elections, which is something we are grateful and we are thankful to the revitalized government for that.
Talk about some of the challenges. You say there were good things and there were some challenges. Talk about the challenges. What are some of these challenges?
There are many challenges, but I will mention few. One of the challenges was the intercommunal violence, which caused loss of lives, destructions, and the displacement of citizens in many parts of the country. The second challenge is the harsh economic situation, which made life very miserable to many South Sudanese. And it has continued even during this Christmas. Many families are not all that happy, 100%. Though you may find people singing, but they just sing maybe 30% or 40% because the economy has hit us on all people. And on top of that, we just received influx of refugees and returnees from the neighboring Sudan because of the ongoing violence there. So this has also added to our misery as South Sudanese, especially the border towns with Sudan have received lots of these returnees and refugees, including the city of Juba. That also adds to our misery.
And what will be your message on this Christmas Day to the people that you're talking about who are going through economic hardship? I mean, I've been here for some days and I can see it on the faces of people on the streets. What will be your message to them?
My message is that as we face these challenges, let's look to the self-emptying Christ Jesus, who put aside power and glory to be born amongst us in fragility, in vulnerability, in displacement and refuge, in order to identify with us in our most profound human struggles. Let's welcome him joyfully. Let's open our hearts to him. Let's love ourselves, forgive ourselves, and express our joy, not because our stomach is full, but because of what God has done to us as we celebrate this year's Christmas.
That's Archbishop Justin Badarama, the head of the Anglican Church in South Sudan. He spoke with VOA's managing editor John Tanza from Juba. The wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and other dangerous places around the world have heightened the need to prepare journalists, non-governmental organizations, healthcare professionals, and civilians to be ready for life and death situations in high-risk environments. Global Journalist Security is a company doing just that. Philip Alexiou reports.
What to do when near an active shooter? Maybe you're getting robbed.
Do what you're told.
Or you're harassed at a military checkpoint. Kidnapped? Just a few of the many scenarios journalists, workers from non-governmental organizations or NGOs, and civilians might face when entering a high-risk area.
Everything!
Through classroom and hands-on training, they can be better prepared to manage and increase their survival rate.
My name is Frank Smythe. I'm the founder and CEO of Global Journalist Security, GJS. I was working for the Committee to Protect Journalists in the 2000s. And during the Iraq War, the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, a number of journalists were killed by firing, including by U.S. forces. And there was an organization that was founded in London called the International News Safety Institute. I worked with the Committee to Protect Journalists to have me serve on the board of that London group representing CPJ to make sure we had a voice. And that allowed me to get a front row seat on the program of providing training to journalists. But by the end of the decade, I decided it was time to start my own organization to provide a different kind of training, incorporating emotional self-care into the training and stress management in a way that hadn't been done before, incorporating digital safety.
Because some browsers are safer than others, so we're going to see that.
Because by the 2010s, it was clear that digital safety was becoming a major aspect of security, which has only increased, and addressing things like sexual assault.
According to UNESCO, 3 out of 4 local journalists around the world were killed outside their office or newsrooms in the year 2020 to 2021.
So I thought we needed smarter training and more appropriate training that would address that reality.
Then you got the detonator here.
I'm Paul Burton, the training director for GGS. We only have 3 days to teach things.
Okay, we've got a mortar round on the right.
So we've got to whittle it down and only teach what they really need and what they can remember.
GGS offers hostile environment and first aid training through an array of programs, including 1 to 5 day courses, along with online classes. Karen Hardy with Hardy Associates travels around the world.
That was amazing. And this is probably going to be the most useful exercise all of us could do, because the chances of the car accident on the road in those countries is...
You do not go out there and get shot. So the first sound is the bullet just missing you.
Indre Sabalunika works with the Marshall Legacy Institute, which helps countries recover from conflict by accelerating landmine clearance operations.
The course definitely helped to prepare me for some unexpected maybe situation that would happen, and I think just increasing the situational awareness.
I think what we're trying to do is teach people similar habits
and protocols that will help them stay safe and maintain an awareness in what is increasingly a difficult and more dangerous environments, both at home and abroad.
Philip Alexiou, VOA News, Washington.
A California company is converting jet fuel aircraft to run hydrogen to reduce emissions that harm the environment. Gina Dulu takes a look at experimental planes that are already in the air.
Test pilot Alex Kroll is ready for takeoff at the Mojave Air and Spaceport.
Mojave Tower, Lightning 1, ready for hydrogen powertrain start.
California-based Universal Hydrogen is converting jet fuel aircraft to run on hydrogen. Company president Mark Cousin says that will cut carbon emissions in aviation as hydrogen produces just heat and water.
And that water just comes out through an exhaust here, and it just comes out behind the aircraft as water vapor. We leave a trail of water behind rather than a trail of CO2 and nitrous oxide and soot and everything else that comes out the back of a gas turbine.
Instead of burning hydrogen in a gas turbine like jet fuel, this technology reacts hydrogen with air in a fuel cell to drive an electric motor. Removing plane seats to make room for the hydrogen cells reduces the number of passengers it can carry, and the electric powertrain is heavier than the gas turbine it replaces. But engineer Loris Gleiner says that is offset by the hydrogen's greater efficiency.
For this size of aircraft, we think that this way is better because the hydrogen fuel cell powertrain is about twice as efficient as the Pratt & Whitney turboprop, so it means that we can, you know, travel twice as far for the same quantity of hydrogen.
The flight is also much quieter. Without a turbine, the only noise comes out from spinning propeller. The company is working toward having hydrogen aircraft in commercial service by 2026, flying routes up to 3 hours long. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, Mojave, California.
And now we bring you holiday greetings from some of our listeners.
I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. My name is Musa Ability from Monrovia, Liberia. Firstly, I want to extend my thanks and appreciation to the entire VOA team, including the VOA Africa team. I want to say I'm proud of you guys. I'm wishing you guys a Merry Christmas and a prosperous New Year. Lastly, all my family and friends, Merry Christmas and a happy, happy New Year.
I am Chisende Mwanza from Kawambwa, Zambia, Mopla Province. I first greet my children, my wife, and all those people that know me here in Kawambwa. I greet all the workers, all the people I work with at St. Mary's School for the Visual Impaired in Kawambwa. I greet all the parishioners at Kawambwa St. Mary's Catholic Church. And I greet my father, my brothers, my cousins there in Kitwe on the Copper Belt of Zambia. I also greet my college mates from Mansa Teachers Training College in Lopla Province, Kawambwa. I also greet people I was with at the Zambia Institute of Special Education. And I also greet all the listeners to VOA, or Voice of America. Merry Christmas, a productive, fruitful, and prosperous 2024.
VOA listeners, I'm one of your great listeners in Juba, South Sudan. I love listening to VOA. I'm very happy at this moment to wish my people Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Please send your Christmas and New Year messages to the following WhatsApp number, 202-258-3076. Once again, 202-258-3076. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Chinedu from Washington. Wishing you Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. We'll see you again Thursday morning.